a hard time it's worth it. I understand you were given a commitment to have yours go right up past.
Yes, that's right.
I'm not sure. Oh, here he is.
Did you promise him he'd go first?
Yes, I did. He wasn't letting me know that with my
back.
You tell
me, and
I'll tell you what's up. I
just
opened the
hearing. Okay. Thank you.
Senator
Hartung, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the courtesy of allowing me to go first. I'm Tom Hartung, Senate District 3. I'm here before you today concerning Senate Bill 1066. You have all the whereases there, but basically what it does, it creates a crime of unlawful horse slaughter. And I'll give you my reasons, and then my aide, Josh Thomas, will tell you more about the bill. This is patterned after an initiative in California that has been law. And I'll just say very quickly that, you know, we all bring our own personal life experience to this process. And the reason that I have this bill before you is that all of my life I have been connected with horses, starting with my grandfather, my parents, and then my wife and I raised our five children on horses, and now our grandchildren are involved also. And we chose the Arabian horse. They are said to be the most sensitive of the light horses in terms of their trainability, and they become like members of the family. And over the years, where I've lived in Cedar Mill for over 45 years, we have had horses there every day of our life, and when the children are at home and we're campaigning, showing horses, we had as many as 10 or a dozen. We have about 5 now, including 3 brood mares, and we're in the business of raising high-quality show horses. And, of course, horses, like people, grow old and need some assistance in having a life that is both, you know, pleasant. And what has happened in the years that we've been there, we've had probably 50 different horses, and I've had some that just grew old. 28-year-old mare, I recall, that required some serious surgery, and I was told the Oregon State University School of Veterinary Medicine said it's not practical to do that, and so we had her put down. And horses are easily euthanized painlessly. And another horse we had, she got ringbone so bad she could not walk. We had her euthanized. And those horses, those carcasses, go to the Eugene Chemical Works, where they are rendered out, and it's akin, in my mind, to being cremated, and that's what I choose for my life. But at this moment, there is no horse slaughterhouse in the state of Oregon where they're slaughtering for human consumption. There was a slaughter plant at Redmond that ALF, the American or the Animal Liberation Front, burned down. And I want to make it perfectly clear, I'm not here to subscribe to ALF's way of dealing with animal rights. This is purely personal. I believe that these animals should be treated in a respectful manner. There are places in the United States where older horses that no longer can do their job, that are still in relatively good health, can be taken to. At this moment, the closest horse slaughter plant for human consumption is in West Alberta, Canada. There's one in Chicago. And in Mexico, they slaughter horses for consumption, human consumption, and the meat, the horse meat, is shipped in bond to Houston, Texas, where it then goes to European countries. And you know, I don't want it to appear that I'm hypocritical. I've been in the beef business for 50 years and never intended to be in the horse meat business. And I don't want to say that other cultures are wrong, that they choose horse meat, but anyway, that's why I'm here, because of my concern and my life's experience with the horse. And Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like my aide, Josh, to give you a little bit of background on the California initiative.
Okay. Chair Bryant, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Joshua Thomas, legislative aide to Senator Hartung, and I'll be testifying today to give background on the California proposition that we try to model our bill after. In 1998, the state of California passed Proposition 6, which was titled the Prohibition of Horse Slaughter and Sale of Horse Meat for Human Consumption Act of 1998. As the title would indicate, the intent of the legislation was to end the slaughter and sale of horses in their state for the purpose of human consumption. California's Proposition 6 passed by a vote of the people by a 60-40 margin, and in their state it is now a felony to sell or slaughter a horse for human consumption. During the campaign, supporters of the proposition contended that the horse slaughter for human consumption was not merely a cruelty issue, but rather a cultural one. California polls showed that 3% considered horses food animals, while 97% considered them recreation, companion, or luxury animals. Horses are recognized and treated differently than food animals in many respects. They are not raised as food animals. Although horses technically fall under the term livestock in California, horses are non-food livestock. Californian horse owners must pay a sales tax on feed, inoculations, and associated products that would otherwise be exempt from taxation if purchased for food or fiber animals. Additionally, the purchase or sale of a horse is subject to a sales tax that food animals are not. All medications used for horses are labeled not to be used on animals intended for human consumption. Before Proposition 6, California horses were being acquired for slaughter, oftentimes without disclosure, many times through fraud and misrepresentation. The California Peace Officers Association attributed the proliferation of the theft of horses to the profitability of the horse slaughter industry that was supplying foreign markets. During the campaign, Proposition 6 drew broad-based bipartisan support. The effort also drew the support of numerous organizations, celebrities, and other well-known supporters. During the campaign, testimony was given by Rick Mangrum, a former Oregon horse slaughter buyer, who witnessed fraud, abuses, and inhumanity in his 12 years as a buyer. He told of atrocities that, if inflicted on dogs or cats, would result in imprisonment. Mangrum advocated for the passage of Proposition 6, stressing that the business of supplying horse meat to foreign markets is wrought with mistreatment, fraud, and deception.
But aren't there other statutes to take care of that?
In California, the perception was no, that it was not addressed.
I believe we have bills or laws in Oregon that would make that a criminal offense.
Well, according to articles and people that are involved, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, is involved with auctioning off wild horses, for example, and there has been cases where they've traced through computer research that BLM employees are adopting these horses, keeping them for the mandatory one-year period, and then are mysteriously unaccounted for after holding the horse. And the conventional wisdom is that these are being sent to slaughterhouse. If I may continue?
Yeah.
Okay. Although Proposition 6 was passed in November of 1998, the result of the legislation has shown an immediate and considerable impact on the horse slaughter business. The Bakersfield, California newspaper reported in February that the ban on the sale for slaughter cut auction sales by about half. The San Francisco Examiner reported that killer buyers, which is a trade term, were conspicuously absent following the new law's passage. One auction observer was quoted as saying, "Real people are now bidding on the horses, while in the past 85% would go to the slaughterhouse." Although it is difficult to attain verifiable statistics on the effect of Proposition 6, due to how new it is, California Proposition supporters do assert that it has indeed resulted in a dramatic reduction in the slaughter of horses for human consumption. In conclusion, in 1971, Congress proclaimed the wild horse as an integral part of our heritage which should be protected. Today, the Bureau of Land Management controls the wild horse population, of which there are an estimated 2,000 now in Oregon, by rounding them up with helicopters and selling them or adopting them out. As I was stating before, after the owners fulfill their mandatory one-year waiting period, an estimated 90% of our wild horses become gourmet meals overseas. Computer records, as I mentioned, have shown that employees may have participated in this sale of horse for profit. Horse slaughter is a clandestine industry. It is transparent to most Americans because it serves foreign markets exclusively. Without disclosure to horse owners, agents with packer and stalker licenses issued by state departments of agriculture oftentimes buy up people's pets and sell them to foreign-owned horse slaughter plants. There is evidence that suggests that the horse slaughter industry may continue to exist here in Oregon even after the Cavell West plant in Redmond burned. Following the success of Proposition 6, Senate Bill 1066 could be the first step towards ending horse slaughter for human consumption in the state of Oregon.
Questions for Ben? Thank you for your testimony. Just for your information, Josh, ORF 6167.315 through 167.340 deal with animal abuse, animal neglect, animal abandonment, and cover the crimes that you were concerned about. So Oregon already has those in statute.
But that doesn't address the sale for slaughter.
No, which is legal in Oregon right now.
Right. That's the point we wanted to make, Mr. Chairman, that it is legal for sale for human consumption.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I just would like to thank Senator Hartung and his assistant for bringing this issue before us. I've introduced several bills for the last several sessions and haven't gotten anybody to even take a nibble, so I'm glad someone's at least taking a nibble.
Pardon me.
Next, we're going to hear about the Galloping Gourmet.
Okay. That was not intentional. But the issue I wanted to raise is one of the bills we have addresses that taking horses to slaughter in vans and vehicles that are not appropriate, so the horses are severely injured and dying on their way to the slaughterhouse, but are, I assume, and also an extreme amount of pain. And I'm just wondering if you had looked at that issue at all in terms of this bill.
In my research, I did find an awful lot of evidence that suggested that in the transport of the horses or in the keeping of them in feedlots, there is a lot of mistreatment going on, and getting them onto trailers, for example, they're often whipped until bleeding, or used cattle prods are used to get them into the trucks, where oftentimes they're double-decker trucks where the urine or other matter has fallen from one level onto the other. There's no room for them to stand, and their heads are oftentimes kept down for distances of upwards of almost 2,000 miles.
Mr. Chair,
yes, sir.
It's my understanding that some of the double-decker and the cattle vans that the horse actually breaks their neck while they're to get into the van or the... So, anyway, thank you for bringing this forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1066, open a public hearing, or excuse me, a work session on Senate Bill 1168. This is our first gotten stuff, and it's brought to us by our own Senator Courtney. And people in the audience, after this, will go to the PERS issues, but as people who testify frequently in front of House or Senate committees are aware that if a senator or representative staff would have a bill, we try to give them the option of going first so they can return to their other duties. Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank the committee, and I thank the audience for being patient because I know it's a huge agenda. The Dash 3 of one amendment to 1168 involve an issue that I think is something that all of us would be concerned about. From my perspective, it involves animal cruelty. When I look at each member of the committee, I cannot be sure how you feel about animals or pets, but one thing I know that every single one of you opposes animal cruelty. In a few minutes, a few seconds, I'll have the Vice President for the National Humane Society present factual evidence of unspeakable pain and suffering of dogs and cats. The death of dogs and cats, all for the purposes of selling their fur coats, selling them for fur coats and other garments. I believe we live in a pet lover society, especially a dog and cat pet lover society. While one may hunt, fish, and even trap, the killing of dogs and cats for their fur is something Oregonians won't support or tolerate. Please consider these thoughtful amendments that seek to protect cats and dogs from certain horrible endings. I really do believe that, after all, a dog, and in some cases a cat for many people, is their best friend. Now, quickly, I'd like to introduce Wayne Caselli, the Vice President of the National Humane Society, who broke this story nationally and received nationwide acclaim, who will talk about what is going on, and he will also talk about the Oregon connection to the killing, or actually skinning of dogs and cats while they're alive and using their fur for a number of garments, and what he knows about it, because I think he is, as we say in law, Mr. Chair, an expert witness on that. So if I could, I'd like to go directly to his testimony. He's handed out some different things, which I find rather repulsive to look at. And so could we do that, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So, Wayne, you need to do, you have to identify yourself and present the situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity. And my name, again, as Senator Courtney has indicated, is Wayne Fuseli, and I'm Senior Vice President for the Humane Society of the United States. And the Humane Society of the U.S. has 62,000 members in the state of Oregon. And I live in Washington, D.C., but I'm very pleased to be here. And I want to start by thanking Senator Courtney for raising this issue. We do consider this a very serious issue, and it is a consequence of this discussion today of an 18-month investigation that was undertaken by our organization and our investigators who spent a good portion of 18 months in China, Thailand, and the Philippines. We had some reports of dogs and cats being traded in international fur markets, and in Leipzig, we were told that this was going on. We went there and did discover some dogs and cats were traded. It eventually led us to China and to Thailand and the Philippines, and what we discovered was a trade in dog and cat fur that exceeded any possible expectation that we could have had in terms of the scope of this industry. We determined that there were more than 2 million dogs and cats killed every year in China alone to supply the international fur industry. And we determined later that these products were ending up in Western European markets and in the United States. Just a couple of words about the investigation. Our staff members posed as international fur buyers and were led around by top government officials of the Chinese government who proceeded to take our people to warehouses where tens of thousands of German Shepherd coats, Golden Retriever coats, Tabby Cat coats were stacked in huge volume. We also witnessed the killing methods that were undertaken to procure the coats. One very gripping image that all of us have ensconced in our mind was of one German Shepherd that was tethered to a fence with a wire noose and had just 6 or 8 inches of length of the noose. And he was wagging his tail in spite of the manhandling that he had been receiving throughout the process because he did trust the people who were handling him. And soon after, a knife was taken and he was stabbed in the midsection and the knife was pulled toward his rear end and he was bled out. And that was his demise. There is no humane slaughter standard in China. These animals were at the mercy, or in many cases, the cruelty of the people who were shepherding them. And it was a remorseless killing that was going on, and it shocked us, and it shocked the country when it was broadcast on Dateline NBC and on other news outlets. I'll tell you that we got nearly 2 million hits on our website soon after this was broadcast. And we are a nation of pet lovers. There are 75 million households in America with dogs and cats, and the population of dogs and cats in homes is more than 100 million. We don't think of animals, dogs and cats, as food animals nor as fur animals. And we believe it's an appropriate policy response to pass a statute that would forbid the sale and possession and killing of dogs and cats for their fur. That's the simple purpose of our visit today to you and our request to expeditiously pass this legislation. We think it's germane here because obviously this is going on in China and in other Asian countries, but the markets are principally in the West. These fur coats are indistinguishable from other types of fur coats like mink and fox. We saw the coats dyed, sheared, and otherwise treated to make them indistinguishable. And the only way that we were able to definitively determine that these coats had an origin of dog and cat was by DNA testing. And we DNA tested many products. And one of the products that we had obtained was we bought a coat in Burlington Coat Factory, which is the largest U.S. coat retailer with 250 outlets across the country, including many in Oregon. And the label on that coat said Mongolia dog fur. And it turned out that the DNA test turned positive for canine, and Burlington Coat Factory then did take all of those coats off of the shelf. It was in trim on the coat. We believe this is the tip of the iceberg. We've subsequently discovered a number of other products, cat toys, dog toys, children's toys, a variety of gloves and hats and other garments. And it's not full-length fur coats we're talking about in the United States, although we did discover that in Russia there are full-length dog and cat fur coats. This is trim disguised as something else or entirely unlabeled or mislabeled. Our report indicates a variety of pseudonyms that go on labels when it's really dog and cat. So not to belabor you with this issue, but we did in your packet include a copy of our report on the subject. We consider this an issue of concern to millions of Americans who are pet lovers. We believe this is a simple action to bar the sale and possession of dog and cat pelts for the purpose of sale. California enacted a statute prior to this investigation. Now about 10 state legislatures are considering similar legislation. Virginia just recently passed a measure similar to the language that Senator Cortin has proposed. And I thank you for giving this consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
But one thing, Mr. Chair, he said the dog that he described had been killed, but as you can see in the pictures in that magazine, which I could not look at more than once, many of those animals are alive as they're being skinned. So many of the animals that are being the permanent, they're at least they're not even dead. They're being skinned alive. So if nothing else, I think I just think that's animal cruelty. That's my opinion, and I think that's a pretty horrible thing to do. So he didn't say that, but I think that the pictures there depict animals that are alive that's just being done to them. So once again, I really appreciate Mr. Chick. I know how busy you are, and how busy the committee is. It should allow us to present this case, so we'll take any questions, comments, or criticisms, because I think the language is well thought out. It's been tested in several other states nationally. You have all the documentation. The Portland Burlington outlet does have a connection to this, so there is an Oregon connection to this. It isn't just other states or other parts of the world.
I have one question on Section 2. The first subsection 1 says it's a misdemeanor if you have culpable mental state, which means you had to know probably that, in fact, this was a domestic dog or cat. Subsection 2 reduces it to a violation if you don't have that couple mental state. That concerns me that it's a violation if you don't know. So what's your thoughts about that?
Well, we do believe that the retailers bear some responsibility in determining what products they're selling. And they need to understand who the middlemen are who are dealing the fur. There can be random analysis of some of the coats. We really do believe that they should bear some responsibility to prove culpable mental state is one matter, but we do believe they really do need to take a number of precautions in order to assure that consumers are not purchasing these coats. It's a consumer protection measure. It's also, I think, for the benefit of the retailers. They should be able to conduct business with the public's confidence that they're not trading in the pelts of dogs and cats. We have seen just a rash of people calling us, hundreds and hundreds of people saying, I don't know whether my coat is dog and cat fur or not. I'm concerned about it. If we could have a strong statute like this, I think consumers would feel more confident.
Well, but that doesn't answer my concern. Normally, you're not guilty of even a criminal violation if you don't have the mental state or knowing or should have known that, in fact, you're violating the statute. But, Peter, you and I can discuss this later. That would be my one concern. Other comments, questions, Senator Tarnow?
Mr. Pacelli, are you under the impression, or I didn't get a chance to go through the document, are they raising and breeding these cats or dogs for just this purpose?
Chairman, Senator Tarnow, this is an industry that exists independent of any other industry. The principal purpose of these animals being raised on some of the dog farms and in some of the families is for fur. Some of the animals then have their carcasses sold for meat, so it is not the only byproduct of the industry, but it's the principal one.
Is there any kidnapping of dogs?
The animals are specifically bred for this purpose, or they're collected or stolen as well. And if you've ever been to China, you know that there is a significant stray problem. These animals are taken up, and then they're reared in these ways and then killed for the fur.
Other questions? Senator.
Is it much of a, speaking as a person who lost a cat, is there much of a problem with people stealing cats and dogs in this country and somehow getting them into that network?
It's a phenomenon known as pet theft, and there is actually federal legislation on the subject under the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which administers the Federal Animal Welfare Act. There are two types of dealers that supply animals to research facilities. Class A dealers are the purpose-bred dealers. They specifically raise dogs and other animals for research. The Class B dealers, which number in the dozens, are random source dealers. And they sometimes respond to free-to-good-home ads. If you see a newspaper ad that says free-to-good-home, these B dealers will sometimes respond to those, take the dog, and then sell the animal to research. Pet theft has occurred here. It was recently documented in Linn County, and it is a national problem. I wouldn't say that it's an epidemic. I couldn't put a particular term on it, but it's a major, major problem.
You mentioned the research, but is there any evidence that the pet theft and you know, buying it under false pretenses is used for the fur trade, or that they're exported? Or
is the chairman, Senator Burdick, there is no evidence of that in the United States that we're aware of.
Other questions? Thank you for coming to Oregon.
Thank
and
you.
Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
We will then close the work session on Senate Bill
1158,
and we will open the work session dealing with PERS and the three bills we have. That's it.
Is it a public hearing?
It is a public hearing, I'm told. And I'd like for Fred or Bob Muir to come forward and explain a suggestion on a technical amendment first, and then we'll get into the public testimony.
He's answering my question.
Okay. All right. Good afternoon, Fred.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Fred McDonnell, Director of PERS, and Steve Delaney, also from PERS. And you would like us to go through the technical changes, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
All right.
And this is on Senate Bill 722.
On 722. And I hope that each of you has a copy of recommended technical changes from addressed to the Senate Judiciary Committee from Steve and me, dated May 5.
I think we do.
All right. I will go through those. First of all, on Section 2, with regard to disability, and there are some questions that we ask, Mr. Chairman, that are for clarification. They're not necessarily suggesting technical corrections, and this happens to be one. PERS reads Section 2 with regards to disability as indicating that the actual disability calculation would still be a full formula calculation, and the disability program would not therefore change. And we've just asked if this is intended.
I do not think we intended to change the current disability situation.
That was our understanding as well, but we thought nevertheless we would bring that up.
Put it on the record. Do you think there needs to be some clarification in the language? Or do you think
no. No, we really don't.
All right.
It's just a point of clarification.
I don't think we changed. From the chair's position and one of the sponsors of the bill, we did not intend to change the disability policy.
All right. Next, on Section 3, regarding the pension plus annuity calculation, which is page 3, lines 21 to 26 in the bill, we note that the language found on lines 21 to 26 was taken from the section of current law which describes the full formula calculation and does not describe the pension plus annuity calculation. The appropriate language is contained in the 1979 ORS. We therefore have made suggested language changes that would strike all language after shall be on line 22 through 26. The wording then would conform to the pension plus annuity language in the previous statutes. And this was a point, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that Mark Johnson, our actuary, also brought to the committee, that if it was left that way, that the total benefit would be 1% when you add the employee account plus the employer contributions, the total would be a 1% as opposed to 1% plus the employer's annuity, or the employee's annuity.
I understand.
Section 7, page 10, lines 30 to 31, and page 11, line 1, disability retirement age for calculation is 58, while normal retirement in Tier 2 and Tier 3 would be 60. We posed the question that this perhaps could cause some disability claims to be submitted that might not otherwise be because of the younger age. The process would remain the same. However, I would add, as far as analyzing those claims for eligibility, but nevertheless, we felt that we would bring that point up to the committee.
Thank you. We'll clarify that.
Okay. Section 11, with regards to the lump sum withdrawal on page 16, line 3, we suggest a change to the title of the section. And a suggested change would be lump sum withdrawal of employer provided pension. And it is presently lump sum withdrawal of employer contributions.
So it would help as far as the explanation of what it is. When they actually put it in the statute, it might disappear, just because what they add here in the bold print is probably more for our benefit than for somebody else. But I appreciate
right.
that, and we'll make that change.
All right. Thank you. Also on Section 11, with regard to the lump sum withdrawal on page 19, lines 1 through 3, the way we read the bill, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that on a lump sum withdrawal of withdrawing both the employee and employer's portion, that would be, in effect, a money match benefit because the language describes the withdrawal of the employer part would match the employee part, and that, in fact, would be a money match benefit.
So your language...
Our language would be recommending an amount equal to the actuarial equivalent of the pension described in ORS 238.300, so on. And we bring that up because we feel that that was the intent of the bill.
Yes, it was.
Also on lump sum in Section 11, page 20, lines 18 through 22, we had a good deal of discussion on this particular language, and we felt it could mean that an individual taking an installment of the double lump sum over 2, 3, 4, 5 years would not be eligible to continue their medical insurance until after they had been paid all of their installment payments. And having multiple distributions like that is just another way to take the lump sum, and we thought that you probably intended for it for those folks to be eligible for their medical as well.
That's correct. So do you have suggested language there?
Yes, sir, we do. And that language...
We have not.
Well, no, we don't have language for that.
All right.
We don't have suggested language for that.
We'll work on that.
Okay. Section 18, Employer Invariable, page 30, line 31, and page 31, lines 1 and 2. With advice from the DOJ, PERS has drafted similar language. The language was careful not to indicate any ownership by the employer of assets within the trust fund. And that has to do with testimony and advice that you've received previously from us as well as the Department of Justice. The language of 722 follows that cautious approach until line 31, which reads, the board shall credit earnings to each public employer. And we bring up the caution flag on that, indicating that the direct crediting to employers would be problematic.
And how would you correct that then? Because at some point the employer does get credit for a portion of the earnings, as I understand it, in certain circumstances.
We had language that we had worked with before, were, for example, Mr. Chairman, was employer amounts.
Rather than
employer accounts.
Okay. I don't have a problem with that, and we can, again, clarify the language and then the intent when we make those changes. Is it Dave Henderson? Probably what we'll do, Dave Hendricks is from Legislative Council, the one who's responsible for drafting, so we'll go into a room when we're done today.
With Mr. Hendricks? Okay. All right. Next, also in Section 18, Employer Invariable, which is page 31, line 5, because employers will not be obligated to match employee contributions to the variable under Tier 3, we suggest adding, and who established membership before January 1, 2000, to the end of line 5, which would limit the employer match to Tiers 1 and 2 members only.
I understand.
Okay, next on section, with regard to section 20, employer withdrawal, page 32, line 2, indicates that employees who continue uninterrupted service with a withdrawing employer, this is when employers choose to opt out, the employer with a withdrawing employer continue in PERS. The employees that who do continue in PERS. And then we ask, what is meant by that term? Are we talking about a total separation, termination, or service, or could a leave without pay period qualify for such an interruption of service? We assume that it means true termination, but the language is not clear.
All right. I understand that point.
All right. Next, on also Section 20, Withdrawal, page 31, line 18. To avoid confusion, we suggest a change which would replace the wording this 1999 Act with the word withdrawal.
I understand.
All right, and last, again, Section 20, page 32, lines 10 to 16. This is the closest that this section comes to in detailing the obligations of an employer who withdraws from the system. However, it is not clear that an employer has any continued obligation to its PERS members after withdrawal. Lines 15 and 16 could arguably indicate that the system owes the employees a retirement benefit, but the employer is not responsible to pay for that benefit. Some very clear statement about the continued obligation of the employer following withdrawal would be helpful.
And do you have suggested language?
We would certainly be able to provide that to your staff.
What we'll do is, I mentioned, we'll put you in a room with Legislative Council
all right,
to iron out the correct terminology.
This is a... testimony is a consortium, as chairman of our actuary, our council, as well as our staff. So we would be happy to work with them.
I appreciate your prompt response in going over this. Does the panel have any questions on the technical amendments? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And if you can stay for the rest of the testimony, I think you'll be a helpful resource on other comments, too.
right.
We'll go with Jim Hill and Raleigh. Right. And committee, you should have a testimony, don't you? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Jim Hill, State Treasurer. With me is Raleigh Wisbrock. Mr. Wisbrock, Raleigh's going to make some comments regarding the bill, and then I have a few minutes of comments myself, Mr. Chair, and we'll be very brief.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock, Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury. To start out our testimony, I'd like to start with the ground rules that we began with when we looked at the PERS situation. The ground rule one that we looked at that I think is applicable here is that the PERS plan is for the exclusive benefit of the beneficiaries, in which the employers and the PERS board must act exclusively to protect that benefit. Participating public employers are not beneficiaries of the PERS trust, and that's as per the Attorney General. And that has guided all of our analysis and evaluation of the bill that's before us today. Another very important point is the unfunded liability for the retirement benefits that will be paid to the current employees is the most significant part of the rate increases for many of the employers, particularly for the larger ones. This problem, according to Elizabeth Harchinko, this problem cannot be addressed from within the retirement fund itself. And I think that's a really important idea to carry forward, that we can't solve part of that problem from within the fund, because that would move benefits from the beneficiaries to the employers.
And none of the legislation proposes doing that.
Correct. Three problems were presented to us, it's just, again, as additional background, and to the Treasury and to the legislature by local governments. And a brief review of those, because they'll be salient to some further comments that we'll make a little later on in the testimony. One, the PERS administrative decisions have affected, to some extent, the situation that we're in now. The first point is interest crediting is not consistent between employer and the employee accounts, and that can be addressed administratively, but it's also being addressed within the bill. There's concern with lack of communication, and that can be improved, and that is about outside the context of the bill. Three, the lack of participation by the employer in the variable account, which can be addressed in the bill. The second major area of concern that was brought to us is the perception that the high market returns have affected the situation negatively. The market has earned phenomenal returns, as you know, over the past 2 years, and it's triggered the use of the money match as the choice for retirees. The fact is that over the past 10 years, PERF has returned an average of 13%, not the extraordinary returns of the 28% that we've been having in the last couple of years. For the past 28 years, we've received generated returns of about 10.3 to 12.9%. So that gives you a really long-term perspective of the kinds of returns to be expected. The point that we'd like to make is that looking at the returns that we generated over the past 2 years, that we have dropped the unfunded liability to the fund itself by 47%. This went unnoticed because at the same time we were dropping that unfunded liability because of the extraordinary returns that we were blessed with, that House Bill 3349 was also implemented. And as we took about $1.2 billion out, we also added back $1.3.2 billion. That basically what that did to local governments collectively is increase their contributions. Three, House Bill 3349 caused a $250 million problem for local governments. Schools in the state have not had the same impact because, as you're aware, the state collects the taxes in one hand, and with the other hand, it pays for the additional benefit that House Bill 3349 created as a solution to the lawsuit that was imposed
Yes, Senator Brown.
So, in essence, this piece there was unjust enrichment by the state, or there was a shifting of cost responsibility to state benefit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, correct. There was a shifting of responsibilities. The state was left harmless because the dollars that the state was collecting for that increased benefit was handed out without detriment to the agencies or without detriment to the school districts. But in fact, local governments were not held harmless. They were picking up about $250 million of that obligation. Additional problems that contributed to the situation that we're in now is the PERS, because the change of the face of the workforce and how the workforce stays in the work environment. The PERS actuary adjusted his assumptions for a number of for the number of years that employers were to pay, and that was from a 30-year average, which is normal, to a reduced 18. People were staying basically into the workforce for a shorter period of time. This caused a significant jump in the employer contribution rates for 1999, and that had to do with the demographics and not market. A number of local employers brought their own unfunded liability into the PERS problem, and many of the they also brought some demographic problems into the problem. The unfunded liability brought is, you know, can't be solved, as we mentioned in our first two premises. You know, who is responsible for that fund, and it only goes to the beneficiaries, and that we can't use beneficiaries' money to solve the unfunded liability problem. The solution the PERS had suggested, and a number of them have been implemented into the bill, just again as backgrounding. Employers can also choose to defer, these are solutions that the PERS board had brought, defer their rate increases until 2001, and they proposed a couple of different steps and systems to do that. And that would have not reduced the cost, it would have put them off and lessened the impact over the next couple of years. Employers can also select amortize their unfunded liability over a 38-year period rather than a 30-year period. Again, all of the costs are going to have to be paid. It just chops up the payments into smaller amounts and makes it more palatable and easier to move into a payment schedule. And finally, on that section, allow the first board are also recommended allowing the reserves to be credited to the same accounts as the earnings were being credited to the employee accounts. Employer accounts and employee accounts should be credited at the same time with interest earnings so that employers would not be in a deficit position. Moving to the bill and then to our major points. The problems addressed in Senate Bill 722. The mandate for employer participation in a variable account to match employee participation dollar for dollar is good, and we support that. Mark Johnson of the PERS actuary says that this will gain employers anywhere from $25 to $66 million. If we look back 2 years and had done that 2 years ago, the impact would have been a savings of about 0.2% on those payments. That's a significant amount that is addressed already by this committee. The bill also exempts employer participation in the variable account out from under the existing statutory capital investments and equities. This gives the Treasury the flexibility to help employers without hitting the cap and risking the fund, and we very much appreciate the language that you had there. It does give us some protection and safeguards the fund.
And that's the language that you and I talked about in my office.
Yes, sir.
Preferred, correct?
Yes, sir. And it's not my preferred. We prefer to be totally from up front of the cap, but we understand the situation. We're comfortable with this and no argument whatsoever.
It's an improvement.
Yes, sir. It's an improvement. Three, the bill allows PERS to pool local governments at one rate or to create a couple of different systems and rates that will help to eliminate the volatility the locals are currently experiencing with their obligation, local governments are experiencing with their obligations. And we can save about $1.2 million from the 1997 valuation. PERS says if pooling had occurred with local employers collectively, it would pay for about $1.2 million of the contributions in 1999. Again, not a small impact, a large impact. And, of course, the bill allowed for a lump sum withdrawals. What problems does Senate Bill 722 not address? And we think the biggest problem that it doesn't address is House Bill 3349. HB 3349 imposed an unfunded liability, as I had mentioned earlier, on the total PERS system of about $1.32 billion. HB 3349 imposed a large local on large local government employers an increase of about 1.3%. Very significant portion of the situation that we're in now. That 1.3% is a huge number in their contribution rates. House Bill 3349 cost shifted to local governments about $250 million.
Over what, 30 years, is that approximately the time
correct.
Frame?
Correct.
Or possibly 38, depending if you go on the new era.
If you amortize it over 38 years, correct. We think that Senate Bill 722 fails to address this cost shift to local governments, and I think we have a solution that we'd like to throw on the table very briefly. We propose the state could share some of its net gain with local governments. The appropriation could begin, not this biennium because we understand the problem that would create in budgeting, but could begin in 2001 to 2003 if the legislature desires. Let me just depart slightly from the text here and just explain because it's a very complex issue and I can do it if I wave my hands a little bit. So, understanding that the combination of the tax and the House Bill 3349 benefit increases. We had PERS employees taxed at a differential rate from federal employees. We're all familiar with that. We created through 3349 as a response to a lawsuit that we lost, a solution that said we will increase the benefits by the amount that we are taxing those PERS employees. So we increased the amounts, we continued to tax, and brought in money. What happens is, as I began to address earlier, that we were bringing in $1.32 billion and paying off the state and school portion of the benefit increase, right, leaving the local government, so those large employers, the local governments, with the responsibility to really pick up the damage on House Bill 3349 to the tune of $250 million. A point that we'd like to make is that what the state is doing is collecting more by about $35 million than it expends on those benefits, the total benefits. It's a windfall, if you will. The state is collecting more. We're suggesting that the cost to local governments, the large employers, is about $23 million for 99-2001. And about $28 million for the next biennium. That the state, in fact, could divert some of that windfall profit to covering, to paying, to holding harmless the local government to the tune of that $23 million or $28 million for the successive biennium. And still have an additional windfall of $12 million for 99-01 and about $30 million for the subsequent biennium. That would not truly affect the state. That the state has a windfall of that, it could really soften the burden. The largest single burden that has created this situation is House Bill 3349. And if you want to do something that really affects it, that could really truly affect what's going on with the local government. It's immediate relief, and would have no negative impact on the state. The state is, again, receiving more money.
It would have to come out of the general fund.
It would have to come out of the general fund. The tax is imposed. The benefit was to be neutral, as we understood it, through 3349. And, in fact, it is not neutral. The local governments are still exposed for that $250 million. This would truly, I think, meet the intent of House Bill 3349 and it would truly hold the local government harmless where they are not being held harmless now. And it would not be to the detriment of to the general fund. I mean, there would be still an excess of $12 million and $30 million that would be applied to the general fund. There's a way of amortizing that over a 30-year period. We'd be more than happy to work with the committee if you chose to have us work with it to work out the details of it. But in fact, we've run this idea through revenue, through legislative revenue. They understand it, and we think our numbers are solid. We think they agree with our numbers. We've also run the concept through additional people. We think we can defend these numbers, and it would be of benefit to you. We also suggest, I'm going to move from House Bill 3349 in that discussion to one final point before I turn it over to the Treasurer. The Treasurer also suggests dealing with the interest crediting issues in statute by amending them into Senate Bill 722. You know, they're very important issues, and everything else is being put into the statute very clearly and responsibly, and perhaps that should be placed in there also because it would address a major area of concern and shouldn't be left ambiguous in an ambiguous manner. With that, I'm available for questions after the Treasurer speaks, of course. I'd like to move to our most salient points, and that would be the opt-out area, and turn it over to Treasurer Hill.
thank you very much, Riley. Again, for the record, State Treasurer Jim Hill. In the 1995 session, I came to the legislature and asked for a task force on retirement. And the reason for that is because it is very apparent that there is a crisis in retirement nationally and in our state. And let me just briefly share with you the findings of our task force. Fewer than half of working Oregonians save for retirement through an employer-sponsored pension plan. Employer-sponsored pensions are not available to many Oregonians. Businesses with fewer than 100 employees constitute 98% of Oregon firms and employ 50% of the total workforce, yet only 27% of employees in these firms participate in an employer pension plan. Statistics show that Oregon is fourth in the nation in non-mortgage consumer debt. The U.S. Census Bureau predicts that by the year 2025, that the proportion of those 62 or older to Oregon's overall population, Oregon's population will be the fourth oldest in the nation. Already, Oregon has an older baby boom population than in most states. National statistics show that the baby boom generation is less prepared for retirement than previous generations. At current savings rates, baby boomers will experience a greater decrease in their standard of living upon retirement than current retirees. Social Security benefits are likely to provide a lower percentage of retirement income to future Oregon retirees because of the large number of baby boomers who will be retiring during the next 20 years. The average income in Oregon is lower than the national average, which means that Oregonians have less money to save for retirement. And, Mr. Chair and committee members, the point of all of this is that what we should be doing is really trying to pull everybody up and not try to pull some people down. And that is really, I think, some of what is happening in Senate Bill 722. To talk about PERS employees in particular, I think that there has been, of course, when it's reported, the ones who have very high retirement benefits are the ones that get all of the attention. But from 1988 to present, a total of 33,850 people have retired. The percentage of retirees retiring with 50% or less than their final average salary, 50% or less, is 56.69%, 57% retire with less than half of what they were making. In terms of the problem of the employer contributions, I mean, the city of Portland, which itself has a tremendous problem, their statement was this. The city of Portland said in a letter dated February 17, 1999, that it is in their best financial interest to fix the existing PERS system rather than to create Tier 3 or to opt out of the system for new hires. Our conclusion is that this fixing the existing system will save money now, while plans to create savings while the other plans create savings very slowly over time. Mr. Chair, with respect to the opt-out, I guess when I look at our PERS system and see what kind of reputation that it has nationally as being one of the best systems, and then saying that, well, you should be able to opt out of the system or encourage people to opt out of it, I have to say that I don't understand. However, if that is the case, if workers are going to be allowed to opt out of the system, have it so that they will go into yet at least another good system, so that they will go into a retirement plan. One of the things that is good about our system is that basically the management of it is done by people. It's done by professionals that most of us as individuals would never be able to hire. And a lot of what happens when people lose their retirement is when they get a lump sum of money, they go out, and they do something that is not in the best interest of their retirement. And you can say, well, that's fine. That's their problem. But the truth of it is that when people get to the point where they're retiring, they may not be able to take care of themselves, and it's going to fall on the state. It's going to fall on us to take care of them if they cannot take care of themselves. Mr. Chair, with respect to Senate Bill 723, this is a bill that removes from the PERS board the employees, represented employees and managers that are public employees. One of the things that is very clear to us in the Oregon Investment Council is that whose money is this? And this money belongs to the retirees. And the idea that they should not be able to have some say about their retirement benefits is, well, there are a number of words I guess you could use for it, but let me just say that it's very, very unfair, and it represents a disenfranchisement. It's, to us, it's very clear who this money belongs to, and to say that they should not have a say about how their plan is administered, especially when you have legislative oversight and things can be changed, Mr. Chair, is really, I think it really is a slap in the face of the people who are in the system. I mean, they worked.
Their say is not eliminated by the change on the board. There still is a representation, and of course, the duties of the board members don't change. The funds still belong to the employees, and you're still held to the fiduciary duties imposed not only by statute but by the Internal Revenue Code.
Yes, but Mr. Chair, I guess what it really sort of boils down to is that we have, with the PERS system, it is a damn good system. It really is. We've had two unusual events. The biggest one is a lawsuit, which we have no control over. The other is really the outstanding performance of the stock market. Now, I hope that the performance of the stock market continues, and I hope we will not have any more lawsuits. But when you look at a good system that provides a decent retirement, not an extravagant retirement, a decent retirement for public employees, when you start talking about creating another tier that will reduce employee benefits in the future and not solve the problem that is in front of us, all that I say is that there is plenty here to fix this system without doing anything drastic to it. And all that I would say is that it's working well. It is not an extravagant system. Yes, it does need to be tweaked, and I don't. And I commend a lot of what's in Senate Bill 722. Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, keep this system intact, and try to remember that it's not always going to be like this. We're not always going to be getting 28% returns. And when this situation turns down, we don't want to have a system where employees are not going to be able to have a decent retirement. We have done a number of things. We've put on conferences. We're educating people about retirement. We've done a number of these things like this. We've tried to show financial leadership at the Treasury, not just do our duties, But there is a retirement crisis here, and let's not make it worse by making benefits worse for public employees. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak to you and the committee.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll now invite Grattan Kierens and Greg Hartman was first, I'm told, so Greg Hartman, please come forward. And I'll call a couple others up at the same time to save a little time. Maria Keltner and we'll stop there for the moment. Greg, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here representing the PERS Coalition, and I won't read in the names of all the unions since I did that last time, and I think you're familiar with them in any event. One thing I wanted to mention, they've asked me to talk to you today, but they are preparing written testimony because of some of the changes they've not gotten that completed. So they have asked that you leave the record open until tomorrow. They anticipate being able to prepare that and submit that to you tomorrow.
And we will leave the record open. And
thank
if
you.
We're not ready to move the bill tomorrow, we'll continue to work it.
I'd just like to address a couple of issues that are part of the bill. And first, the third-tier proposal. It comes as no surprise that we oppose the creation of a third tier. But we do that not only because we see that as providing a lower level of benefits for future employees. We see it as simply being non-responsive to whatever problems currently exist in the system. It should be abundantly clear by now that a third tier, in terms of savings, whatever savings are generated by the third tier, are going to take many, many years to generate. For the first 5 to 10 years, you could basically eliminate pensions for new hires, and you really would not see any significant savings. So we see the third tier response as being the wrong response to what has been identified as the problem. So we start from that perspective that we just really see a heading in a direction which does not seem to be addressing what seems to be the concern raised, particularly by some of the local jurisdictions. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure which proposal is currently under consideration. Fred McDonald pointed out that the current language of your bill does not duplicate the 1981 system. And it was not clear whether it's the committee's intent to move to the 1981 model or to continue with the current draft of the bill. I don't want to spend time talking about something you're going to change, but it should be very clear that the current draft of the bill does not duplicate what we refer to as the Annuity Plus system from 1981. The current draft of the bill simply sets up a 1% per year service pension for general service and 1.35%. So, again, I don't know what where you're going on that, but if you are going to continue the current language of the bill, it's very, very different from what we had in 1981 and much, much less of a pension for those people who would come under that system. Another point I want to make is you talk about third tier. I have heard it said that the committee has talked about setting goals. For instance, 75% of final average salary when you count in Social Security. If you take that approach, in other words, if that's the analytical tool that you want to use to start your analysis, then one other very important issue that you need to take into account, and that's what I refer to as the gap problem. I mean, recognize that, and this is particularly acute for police and firefighters, commonly complete their 25 years of service, which we've always regarded as a full career, in their early 50s. And so these individuals may have as much as 10 to 12 years before they will be eligible for even a reduced Social Security entitlement. And so as you think about, if it is truly your goal to say that we want a retiree, for instance, to have 75% of final average salary over the course of that person's retirement, you got to aim higher in the early years because they're not going to have the benefit of Social Security for a number of years down the road. And none of the analysis that I have as yet seen that takes that approach really examines that gap problem and addresses that in a way which recognizes, as I say, that people are not going to have the advantage of Social Security potentially for a number of years after retirement. So again, if that's the analytical tool that you're going to use as you start thinking about whether you really want a Tier 3, then I ask you to keep that in mind. The other point I'd like to make is that as we look forward,
I think you're going to find that there's no magic in this business. You can't make significant savings for employers without significantly adversely impacting the amount of retirement that people are going to enjoy. To the extent that you may believe there are structural problems with the current system, that's a different issue. But if you're really looking to make savings, in other words, to say we need to save 2, 3, 4% of payroll, the only way you can do that is substantially reduce benefits. There's no magic to this business. You don't put as much in on the front end, you're not going to take as much out on the back end. And I think you begin to see that as you see the comparisons, for instance, that Mark Johnson has prepared for some of these proposals. Let me turn for a moment to some of the immediate relief issues that I think you can and should address. I guess I should start with the Treasurer's proposal that they just made. I guess I could call that the Share the Pain proposal, because in effect what they're saying is that to the extent there is a pain, a financial burden that has been created by our tax problem, which was addressed by House Bill 3349, the Treasurer suggests that perhaps there can be some backfilling from the state to the local jurisdictions, which would help, as I say, share that financial pain. Some history on this, and I was involved in the lawsuit, the infamous lawsuit, as well as 3349. We knew at that time that this was going to create a financial burden on local jurisdictions. That was why they resisted House Bill 3349. However, now we're several years down the road, and it has now become an impetus for changes in the system, and perhaps a better approach, and one certainly that the coalition supports, would be to look at some kind of proposal like the Treasurer's, which says, let's readjust that fiscal burden. Let's think about ways to attack that. The PERS coalition would strongly support that kind of approach. We recognize that's a difficult issue. We recognize that that means some money will not be available in the general fund, and that directly impacts some of my clients. But nonetheless, we recognize that a readjustment may be appropriate. So we would suggest, and in fact, beyond suggest, encourage you to consider that kind of solution. We've already talked about some things that will help deal with the current structural problems in PERS. For instance, allowing the employers access to the variable account. We have supported that from the outset. We've talked about the concept of pooling, of allowing local employers to pool their obligations so you don't have an e-web coming into you 10 years from now saying, how did we get into this predicament? We support pooling. There are already studies going on, rulemaking within the PERS system, to try to determine whether there are any unfairness in some of these accounting issues that have been raised. And if, in fact, it turns out that there is some problem there, that's already being studied within the PERS system. There are things currently going on, I think, things that you can study which would give immediate relief to local jurisdictions. Developing a third tier is simply not going to do that. I'd like to just say one other thing about the proposal or the bill's language which would permit the withdrawal of employers. It just seems to me you're going in absolutely the wrong direction, and for a couple of different reasons. As the state treasurer made clear, we have a good system. It is a system which is to the benefit of every level of government in the state of Oregon. One of the very important parts of that system is portability. People can move from employer to employer without jeopardizing their PERS entitlement, allowing people to move to the highest job they can perform. If we begin allowing people to drop out of the system, portability is going to be challenged. Secondly, what kind of self-selection is going to go on and who drops out of the system? It's certainly not going to be those employers who don't have perceived they have funding problems. It's going to be the employers who do. And finally, you're going to have to deal, particularly if we're going to have pooling, you're going to have to deal with employers who withdraw after pooling, and really we're going to create the identical situation that you see in the private sector in multi-employer plans. And for those of you who are familiar with the ERISA requirements on multi-employer withdrawal, they are voluminous because you have to deal with what happens when you've had a pooled account and an employer wants to withdraw. The employer cannot withdraw from the amount that is owed in that pooled account. So you have, if you really want to even consider withdrawal, and I would urge you not to, you have a lot of issues in addition to what Mr. McDonald already addressed that I think this committee is going to have to address.
On the pooling issue, if that happens, the employer that leaves has to leave the system actuarially sound. So whatever the actuary would determine had he left with PERS would remain there. Likewise, if they pool and they stay in PERS, and we know that, for instance, eWeb, City of Portland have an unfunded liability. If they were later pooled, that unfunded liability would still remain the responsibility of that public entity.
That's my assumption, but the administration of that concept can become fairly complex. Once pooling has begun and we've begun sharing obligations, there may well be unfunded liabilities in the future in the plan, and you're going to have to address that problem too, because the employer will continue presumably to be responsible for those unfunded liabilities. So again, I would hope the committee would address the problem, which we perceive to be the immediate issues, and really move away from Tier 3 proposals which don't address that. So, unless there are questions, thank you very much.
Questions today? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
The record will remain open for...
Thank you very much.
Grattan?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Terrence, representing the Oregon University System. At your March 24 hearing on these bills, Denise Junker, who is the Human Resources Manager for OUS, and myself appeared in front of your committee, highlighting our concern that House Bill 3395, which was adopted in 1995, legislative session granting the optional retirement benefit for employees of the higher education system, not be adversely impacted by your actions in these bills. We have followed the course of the legislation. I've spoken with legislative counsel, your committee counsel, observed the committee hearings, listened particularly closely in the interchanges yesterday between members of the committee and Director McCall, and have examined the -2 amendments to 722 and heard Mr. McCall's recommendations to you regarding technical amendments. And it is the considered opinion of counsel and myself that the optional retirement plan under 243.800 is unaffected and would remain in force without impact, as I understand the bills. Appreciate your consideration for that, and wanted the record to show that it was our common understanding that that was the case.
That is our understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Maria.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maria Keltner. I represent the cities and counties, the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties. I want to thank you for your work that you've done on Senate Bill 722 and other areas dealing with the concerns that we brought to this committee at some earlier testimony. We are very supportive of the portion of Senate Bill 722 that deals with allowing the employer account to make up that variable mismatch problem, which has been a long-standing problem and has grown over the last 20-plus years. Handed out to you is some testimony that I will not read that deals with the importance of the variable mismatch, and using some figures out of a PERS perspective and adding the last year, these figures would indicate that from 1970, if an employee put a dollar into the variable account, it would have grown to $28.99 as of the January of 99, whereas the dollar in the regular account would have grown to $17.45, and that is the mismatch. The employer's dollar grew to $17.45. The employee's dollar grew to $28.99. So we would urge you to support that portion of the bill. In terms of the Tier 3 that has been proposed, one other comment on the variable mismatch. Whatever the name is that is called of how the employer gets credit for those variable earnings, the important thing is that it get credited to the employer account balance at some point, because that is what drives the employer rate. If it doesn't get credited to the employer account balance, it's not going to help in terms of the rate. In terms of Tier 3, we believe that this would help correct some of the structural problems where there are three different benefits that are calculated, or two for current retirees, and they are funded in a different way. And so there was a large problem when the majority of people were going out on a formula benefit and it shifted to a money match benefit in terms of the funding strategy and the funding method. So we support eliminating the structural problem that results from different kinds or a hybrid kind of system. There is some concern in regards to pooling local employers, depending on which employer. We think that this is a concept that's worth exploring further. We don't want to have a mandated pool where employers are mandated into one pool. We haven't done all the research because we don't know what the pooling concept would be or what the exact cost would be, but there's been some question raised in terms of whether, depending on how the local employer's rate might increase, that it might be an unfunded mandate for some of the local employers. Again, we're just looking at that area. There was a suggestion that was brought forward by one of the cities and counties, which would be, because of the concern over mandated pooling, suggestion that individual local entities be allowed to join the state community college pool, which would pool some of the locals, or maybe all of them, into a pool without mandating that everyone go into a pool as a local. The withdrawal option for locals, just to briefly talk about the opt-out option, you heard testimony from several cities and counties who have their own local pension plan, spoke about how that was working. And I would reiterate that with the problems that locals are facing, there is a significant need to either correct all of the problems or allow the opt-out. One of the areas that is not discussed in this bill deals with the earnings distribution biases. And as we work more with PERS, we find additional biases that need to be addressed. And we would encourage language, legislative language or statutory language, to deal with the equitable distribution of earnings to all accounts. Well, thank you for your time and attention.
Question for Maria. Thank you for your testimony. Our final witnesses on 722 are Jim Witte and Christina Squire. And as I mentioned yesterday, the bill will be amended to include all, what do we call them?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina Squires, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Jim Witte had to be called away, and so the only 2 points that I would like to make on behalf of the Special Districts Association with regards to Senate Bill 722 is that if the committee chooses to move the portion of the bill that deals with employer local option, where it says city and county, if you would just add special districts into that mix. And also would like to express our association's concern for the local government pooling portion. We're just not quite there yet on that issue.
Thank you. Questions, Christine? We appreciate it. We'll then close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 721, the Dash 1 Amendments, and invite 723, I'm sorry, invite Fred back, also former Representative Tom Whalen, and Maria Kelton.
Mr. Chairman, Fred McDonald, members of the committee, Director of PERS. Mr. Chairman, did I hear correctly, 723?
723.
723.
You signed up for it.
Yes, sir, I did. Yeah, I thought you said 721. But
I did, okay. But I was wrong.
Okay. And I also had some testimony on 722 that I had signed up for. I'm sure I signed up for it. But
I thought you'd given that.
Well, I just did the technical corrections on that.
Okay.
Now, I can do it at another time. I could be very brief and do it right now.
Why don't we go back then and we'll close, Tom, stay right. We'll close the public hearing on 723 for a moment and go back to 722.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since the Senate Bill 722 has been introduced, we have met with our board and did so this morning because I wanted the board to have the opportunity to express its points of view with regard to 722. And I will go through what their positions are on the various components of the bill. First of all, on the Tier 3 part of it, what I'm going to tell you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is the board has some no positions, they have some neutrals, and they have some support. On the benefit calculation Tier 3, they determined that their position is neutral because they have historically taken that position with regard to benefit increases or benefit decreases, feeling that it is a legislative policy-making decision. On the lump sum withdrawal of employer contributions, the board is in support of this concept. However, I would add that a good deal of discussion, similar to what Treasurer Hill indicated, that people may do things with their lump sums that they would not do otherwise if they didn't have it all at once, and there is concern about that. But nevertheless, even in view of that, that's their decision, and therefore that the PERS board is in support of it because they feel that it is a win-win with regard to employers as well as retirees who would choose to do that. The pooling of local governments. This is a tough issue, as they all are. However, the board feels strongly that this is a unique period of time that we have to go about the pooling process, and that the positives outweigh the negatives. Over time, there are going to be difficulties in getting everybody on board to begin with because some rates will go up. We've had testimony in that regard from an employer, City of Portland, that whose rate would go up, but we're in support of it. And we would have testimony from others, I'm sure, that would be opposed to it. However, from the standpoint of the long-range good for the system, we feel and our board feels that pooling is a big advantage to stabilize the rates over time. And the language that is in the bill is proper in that it gives the board, and as well as requiring of the board, that it take into account and go through a very deliberate process to bring about pooling, if that in fact is what the board would decide to do. The employer participation in the variable, very much in favor of that, as we have always been. The withdrawal option for cities and counties, we're opposed to the concept for the reasons that have already been stated, and I don't think I need to state them again. It primarily has to do with the long-range actuarial viability of the system, the distribution of earnings to employer accounts in mid-year, which is, I'm told, going to be added to the bill, that we're very much in favor of that as well. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony. Are there questions on this testimony from Fred? If not, then we will again close the public hearing on Senate Bill 222, open the public hearing on Senate Bill 723. And Fred, if you could identify yourself.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Fred McDonald, PERS Director. Again, at our same board meeting this morning, we discussed Senate Bill 723. I have written testimony that you have provided. I'll go through it very quickly. The PERS board does not believe that it is appropriate to require public members to have experience in investing, which was one of the provisions of the bill. The PERS board is not directly involved in the investment of the PERS trust funds, as it's the duty of the Oregon Investment Council. Secondly, where a public member of the PERS board has been called to serve on the OIC, of which one of our PERS board members is, the requirement that the member has investment knowledge. If there has been a conflict of interest, then that does pose a conflict of interest, and people then would have to recuse themselves. And that has been done, will continue to be done, because certainly conflicts are very possible to occur. Thirdly, the PERS board notes that anybody who serves on the PERS board would have the same fiduciary responsibility. That's been talked about, Mr. Chair. You brought that up, and the board feels that they are definitely in agreement with that. Whoever they are, they would have the same responsibility. The PERS Legislation Committee, having reviewed a committee of our board, having reviewed the legislation for the PERS board, that there is a concern in reducing the elected official, the local government elected official will be reduced from, which is now 2 to 1, and that they feel is a direct advocate for the taxpayer, and that would be lost from the board. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for Fred on this testimony? Thank you. Tom, welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sitting here, I'm reminded why I... Well, I'm not missing this as much as I thought I might.
It's good for you to tell us this, because some of us are term limited out.
You know, this is an anecdote I'll share with you, and this is God's truth. When I was on the first floor back in 89, I was sitting in this room with an endless stream of petitioners coming before me on some arcane area of pension law, trying to stay awake much as my colleagues today are. And I remember leaning over to the person next to me and saying, what kind of an idiot would ever run for the legislature and have to do this for 6 months straight? I knew this was being discussed. And so just the other night, it occurred to me that I may have some personal history that might be of some value to you folks as you make a decision on changing the composition of the first board. I'm just speaking to the point, -1 amendments. I've got 21 years in the system as a firefighter under the police fire provisions. I was the first public safety rep appointed to the board back in 1989 when the board was expanded. I'll give you a little bit of history of how that came about when it was expanded to include employee members as well. And I've been a legislator, and I've been impatient with and irritated by agencies in the past, so I know that sometimes creates legislation. My initial involvement with the PERS was as a result of a 1973 law passed by this legislature that required all employers of police officers and firefighters in the state that are outside of PERS to provide benefits that are equal to or better than the ones in PERS. It seems simple and straightforward, a mandate from the legislature. Our experience was that the rules were adopted to implement that statute were simply fashioned in such a way that nobody would have to upgrade their plans. The whole purpose of that law change was that there were terrible plans out there. We had one. And lo and behold, when we thought we'd found the gold at the end of the rainbow, it turns out that the administrative agency had simply undone what the legislature had done, had willed. And so we took them through the hearings process, through the administrative procedures process. We sat before their hearings officer, and on 57 issues that we'd raised, he held for us on 57 issues. For example, we had to work an extra 5 years to get a benefit. We had to work to 55, those years where you really start breaking up. I'm now entering into that era. When they evaluated the plan, whether it was equal to or better than PERS, they didn't require that the employer contribute to the plan. We could have had an equal to or better than plan if the employers themselves had to pay every single last dime of it. So we prevailed at the hearings level. The fact was so outlandish. We went to the board. The board said, take us to court. Forget it. We don't care. So we ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court on this, getting a very interesting and complete education in Oregon administrative law circa early 1980s. And the Supreme Court, while they held it for us on a few occasions, said this has been a broad delegation of authority to this agency. We don't want to second guess them. While admitting that the facts certainly didn't look good, they didn't want to find themselves in the position of having to second guess every agency in the world. So we were sufficiently offended by that, and the other two branches of government were sufficiently offended by that, that by 1989, there was a bipartisan effort to open this board up to employee representatives. And I'll tell you who was quite vocal in this. Some old colleagues of mine, now term limited, were Eldon Johnson and Bill Markham. They got tired of being screamed at by public employees who, 6 months after they were no longer getting a paycheck from the employer, they had yet to receive a retirement check. The board itself was completely unresponsive. You could not find out if you could retire because you couldn't schedule a time to sit down with a benefits counselor. There just weren't enough of them. And the board was completely unresponsive. You've got to understand, that board was coming out of the era when the main function of that board, as they saw it, and certainly as envisioned by Roger Meyer, who chaired that board and put the fund on a sound financial footing, was they were interested in investing and handling the monies that were being created by the fund, and they did a wonderful job. But as far as the administrative side of it, not quite so. PERS at that time, I think Fred was there, was a terrible place to work. Anxious, angry employees calling all the time. So in that 89 session, they did a couple things. They took that investment function, and I think wisely gave that to the Oregon Investment Council. People understood that business, and they gave the job of creating a workable administration for the retirement benefits to the PERS board. And I was, as I said, one of those first new members appointed to that board. Ed Schroeder, the state forester, was the chair of the board at that time. He told me, quite frankly, he was opposed to it being expanded to include public employees. And this is 6 months after we'd come on. At that point, he said to me, I was dead wrong. I've never seen this system look so promising, work so well. So you find that the PERS board now is simply trying to make a retirement system work. It is tedious, tiring, brain-numbing combination of administration and actuarial arcania that isn't for everybody. In fact, after one term, I bailed out of that, too. But I see this as a giant step backwards, and I see that we're reducing. I'm talking about just from the employees' perspective now. We've got, I believe those figures are 135 active and retired members, 135,000, excuse me, 235. I got it right now? 235 retired and active members. And what this will do, this proposal in the Dash Ones, will cut that back to two representatives on the board. Now, we spent most of our time on the phone in the evenings fielding complaints from those members and being an intermediary with the administration themselves to hopefully get these people retirement checks and handle whatever other difficulties they're having. As this is proposed, as I read it, you're going to have two people now representing this 235,000 members. I'm assuming that probably 80 to 90% of them are actually worker employees. The management corps will probably make up 15-20 at the most percent. I'm not sure what that span of control is across the system. But you're going to leave two management reps and cut back to two employee reps. That is just that is not going to work. The complaints generated. The sense that they've simply been abandoned and their interests are not being paid attention to are going to be inevitable. You're going to hear about it. Certainly the board members are going to hear about it. The new public members are going to hear about it. And I would only encourage you, if you have problems with the PERS system, deal with it legislatively. Give specific charges to the PERS board. Don't take away a system that in more recent years has been one that would listen to the employees that are members of it.
That Thank concludes. You for that insight. It's good to hear from a former board member. Questions for Tom? Thank you for the testimony.
Thank you very much.
Last witness on this is Maria. Do you wish to testify?
Once again, for the record, Maria Keltner representing cities and counties. Cities and counties are interested in taxpayer citizen voice in matters that concern cities and counties, such as the PERS board. Recently, we had the opportunity with a resignation of the retired member of the board to actually be able to submit some names to fill the second elected official position with an elected official. Since the time that these positions were established for so many for the union, so many for management, the second local position has always been filled with a retiree. So we've had one local official during that time. And we specifically looked for an elected official within the cities and counties who was not a member of PERS, because we felt that self-interest can color the exercise of the fiduciary responsibility. We found some, we proposed some names to the governor, and I understand that that's part of the process now in terms of changing the board. But we do support Senate Bill 723 in terms of the change for the board.
Thank you. Questions for Marie? Thanks, testimony. We will now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 723. And It's Dave downstairs. If you wouldn't mind going downstairs and showing Dave your textual amendments, if he doesn't already have them, and where some wording is missing, or suggesting wording, I'd appreciate if you could give that to him. Thank you. We'll now go into a work session on Senate Bill 944 and Bill 10. And Gina McClard. Thank you. For those here, we do intend to do our best to get through the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. There are dash two amendments on Senate Bill 944 where we've attempted to address some of the concerns that came up at the public hearing on 944. Would you like me to just describe what those amendments do, Mr. Chair?
Please, if you would. I have found them now, and I found the original bill.
Okay. The first issue on page one of the bill was to delete earnest resistance from the definition of forcible compulsion, because Oregon was one of only five states that still retained some type of issue where a victim in a sex crime must fight. And so we struggled with some words to deal with the issue of, well, what is physical force here if it doesn't have earnest resistance? We mentioned that Oregon in 1971, when we adopted this definition, we had patterned our new law after Michigan and New York. And so what we did was, this language is actually the New York statute. And so the dash two amendments go and take the present New York statute and now put that into the bill, so that our bill continues to track New York law. And it's clear that when they dealt with this issue of pulling out earnest resistance, what they did was they brought in this language: forcible compulsion means to compel by physical force or a threat, and then it just tracks precisely the same. So we've added the words to compel with physical force. And as I said, this is the exact language in New York, and that's where our original bill in 71 came from.
I think on line 8, then on page 1, that answers my concern. Before we go to page 2, are there questions that the committee has on that change? All right. One of them, we go to page 2.
Now, on page 2, we had the issue of clothing, and brought forward the concept that the manner of dress of a victim should be irrelevant, just as a victim's prior sexual history is irrelevant now under the statute. And there was some concern that the original bill didn't read very well. It was confusing to examine. And so what we did was, we went back, and since subsection 2 concerning prior sexual history has been the law for a number of years, it requires a pretrial hearing about prior sexual history. So what we tried to do in our new subsection 3 for manner of dress, we tried to track the same language as is presently in subsection 2. And so that's what these amendments will do. First of all, there is a prohibition from using reputation or opinion evidence for prior sexual history. So we have, with these amendments, brought that same prohibition of reputation and opinion history about manner of dress. Now, in simplistic terms, that simply says you aren't going to get up there and use gossip or your own personal opinion about how somebody dresses, because that's really a subset of this history issue, that we aren't going to allow reputation or opinion evidence about someone's prior sexual history. Well, it's the same issue on their manner of dress. So the First Amendment says here in the law, with adopting these amendments, we aren't going to allow reputation or opinion evidence about manner of dress. just like we don't allow that kind of evidence for prior sexual history. But then we drop down into the new subsection 3, and this talks about when will manner of dress become allowable in a criminal trial. I don't know if Senator Courtney had a question or if I...
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. So subsection 3 now will tell us when is it allowed. And we've made some deletions here and tried to pull out language that made it difficult to understand. But it says, notwithstanding the prohibition of never using opinion or reputation evidence, you can bring into a criminal trial evidence when it is necessary concerning motive or bias, or is necessary to rebut or explain scientific or medical, and we've added in here, or testimonial evidence, or when it's necessary to establish identity, or when it's constitutionally required. So that's the way this would read. Now, we tried to think about when would you need to bring in evidence of manner of dress. And I must tell you, again, as I've thought about this, in other crimes, I must say I've never asked a victim, well, what clothes were you wearing when you were driving the car before your car was stolen, or what clothes were you wearing when you were burglarized, or what clothes were you wearing when you were robbed. However, it does come in when you talk about identity, so that's one of the specifics put here. It needs to come in when you talk about motive or bias, and so that's specified. And we expanded the scientific and medical evidence exception to include testimonial evidence, because of concerns the defense would have that, gee, there would be times when statements made by the victim, I need to be able to talk about manner of dress. And so clearly that's why we've added testimonial evidence. So we think we've expanded that.
So if let me give you a hypothetical, where there was an issue of whether or not the victim was grabbed. He grabbed my clothing. To me, under this exception, the clothing then would, what the description of the clothing would obviously have to come into evidence. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, where I'd see that coming in, or the victim testify, yes, I was grabbed and my sweater was ripped. And we have the sweater, and the sweater is not ripped. Clearly, that's going to come in that testimonial discussion impeachment. I think it comes in both in the testimonial exception, but also I believe that impeachment is constitutionally required, that the defendant is allowed to bring forward that type of impeachment.
And what I'm suggesting by the word testimonial, anytime the testimony starts talking about the clothing in that manner, you know, he or she grabbed my shirt or whatnot, then it becomes relevant evidence where you could say, all right, describe the shirt.
And Mr. Chair, my issue here is that we want to have that issue determined by a pretrial hearing with the court, just as we do now about prior sexual history. But I would see that would be primarily where clothing would come into play. It was torn, it was grabbed and stretched or whatever, and now it obviously that becomes an issue. A factual issue for the jury to look at to determine whether or not that's corroborative or impeachment of the victim's testimony. But we did expand that to try to get at that issue. Again, one of the issues that you and the committee raised in the hearing.
Well, and I, and not being a trial attorney any longer, to me it's also relevant and testimonial because it gives you an accurate picture of what the setting would be. Because if two people are wrestling, I think they both would have the right to describe in full what in the heck took place there, including
what clothing was involved, and that's what, and I think you'd have a constitutional problem too if that that type of evidence wasn't allowed.
Mr. Chair, my only concern about the setting is I can't imagine why is it that we need to have the setting of what clothing I am wearing today in this Senate hearing, other than to suggest that my clothing in some way describes my character. If I wore a t-shirt and sandals, that someone would want to bring forward that I testified in front of a committee wearing a t-shirt and sandals. So what kind of person is Dale Kent? And that exactly is the message that is not supposed to be allowed, that clothing in some way invited this attack or in some way detracts from the character of this person. However, with the exceptions that we have here, factually, the testimony, the scientific evidence, the medical evidence, or these other issues, yes, you should, as a defense counsel, be allowed to bring forward that the clothing was involved in a struggle, and that goes to physical force. Therefore, we should be allowed to bring that forward. I just wanted to focus it in on the elements as opposed to setting the scene.
I understand. Question. Now, the challenge is, without an A in gross, or excuse me, a hand in gross, reading the bill with the changes in it. Could you do that?
I can't do that for you, Mr. Chair. If you're looking at the original bill up on line 8, the new sub B, it would say, reputation or opinion evidence presented for the purpose of showing that the manner of dress from an alleged victim of a crime incited the crime or indicated consent to the sexual acts alleged to the charge. And that's basically just saying that reputation or opinion evidence isn't going to come in about dress. Okay? But then down below in the new subsection 3, which is line 20, it would read, notwithstanding any other provision of law, in a prosecution for a crime described in ORS 163.355 to 163.427, or in a prosecution for an attempt to commit one of those of these crimes, evidence other than reputation or opinion evidence of the manner of dress of the alleged victim or a corroborating witness presented by a person accused of committing the crime, strike all of the next line, 24 and 25, is also not admissible unless the evidence is admitted in accordance with subsection 4 of this section, pretrial hearing, and is evidence that A, relates the motive or bias of the alleged victim, B, is necessary to rebut or explain scientific, medical, or testimonial evidence offered by the state, C, is necessary to establish the identity of the victim, or D, is otherwise constitutionally required to be admitted.
Thank you. That's helpful.
And that tracks precisely subsection 2 above it, which deals with the prior sexual history and, as I said, is in law and has worked well in the courts.
Questions on the dash 2s? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
In fairness, Ingrid, do you want to add anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
She likes me to speak with her.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just a couple of comments because you did hear my testimony the other day. There is no provision in here for admitting the evidence when it goes to the issue of consent, when it's direct evidence of consent. So that if a person basically had said, when I wear X, that's a signal to you that I agree to some kind of sexual contact. That is not admissible here unless you go to the effort of finding a constitutional basis for that coming in. So that's a possibility, but it obviously it puts the burden on the defendant when it doesn't need to be, when consent is clearly intended. Again, I remind the committee that only relevant evidence is admissible in any case. So we are assuming that clothing is relevant in this proceeding, and you are deciding here to nevertheless prohibit the introduction of relevant evidence because a higher policy indicates that that evidence, even though relevant, should not be admitted. And the court will have to read it that way because the law already prescribes the admission of irrelevant evidence. So I just wanted to remind the committee of that. And again, with respect to clothing, I think the better way to handle it is to talk about the physical object. When that object, for some reason, is relevant, the defense should not be limited to using it in rebuttal. They should be allowed to use that in their case in chief as relevant, admissible evidence when it meets those criteria.
Wouldn't that be allowed under B now, where it says it's necessary to rebut or explain scientific or medical testimony?
It certainly would be under some circumstances, but the defendant might wish to introduce it as part of his or her case, even in those situations where the prosecution had not introduced evidence directly relevant to that piece of physical evidence.
Well, my reading of that line would allow you to do that, because to me that would be testimonial evidence that the defendant wished to bring in if you met these other criteria.
Well, maybe it would be physical evidence, not scientific, not medical, not testimonial, but some piece of physical evidence that you want to rebut. There are all kinds of evidence, and I think the clearer course would simply be to say then that object is itself relevant evidence that it ought to come in, and distinguish that from the matter of dress issue.
This is one I imagine we'll know in 2 years whether or not it's constitutional. I'm speaking of the latter changes, not the changes to the first page. But to both of you, has this language ever been tested in other states as far as appellate court decisions?
Mr. Chair, that is why we attempted to stick with the model of subsection 2 above it, because that has been in place for a number of years concerning the admissibility of prior sexual history. And we really see the element of how a victim is dressed is really kind of a sub-argument of prior sexual history. We have said by policy, you aren't going to bring forward whether or not you think someone or their reputation is bad about prior sexual history. And in fact, we aren't going to allow evidence of prior sexual history unless you meet these tests. And that's the same process that we're using, the same language and the same process, although we have expanded a little bit to bring in testimonial evidence. And I would agree with the chair's analysis that under that example that was just provided, that it would be admissible under this process.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Committee, we are in work session on Senate Bill.
Yeah. Two amendments to Senate Bill 944.
Senator Q-Sub moves the dash. Two amendments to Senate Bill 944. Discussion? Objection? Senator Q-Sub. Motion is to send Senate Bill 944 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection?
So ordered. Well, now the work session.
Q-tip is not carried. Thank you. Work session on 1207, and we have some amendments and an explanation.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I would suggest that we bring up Kelly Taylor, who is good for the DMV. This is a bill that the law that we passed in 1995 concerning suspension of gathering privileges and revocation of driving privileges and the commission of certain crimes and motor vehicles involved.
And if you recall from the testimony, there were some changes that need to be made in the bill that Mr. Dole agreed to. And thank you, Kelly, for waiting. If you'd like to highlight for us the substantive changes, not the technical changes, on the dash three amendments.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. On the dash three amendments, I would direct you then to pages, third towards the back. I would head to page 16, Mr. Chair. And the substantive changes in the dash three from the original bill are a couple of things. This bill is taking assault 2, 3, and 4 and changing it, instead of being a revocation, it's allowing it to be a suspension with a hardship permit. And some of the changes you see starting on, say, lines 28 of page 16 of the dash 3 and going through about halfway through of page 17 is lining up that wait time for the hardship permit. It's basically trying to do the same thing as it did for when you could get your license back completely if you were suspended. For example, it's saying that you have to wait a certain amount of time for hardship. If you're incarcerated, that wait time begins upon release. If you are not incarcerated, that wait time begins upon when the suspension took effect. So it's trying the same theory of you will notice your wait time just like you would notice being suspended. Again, when you get, if you're incarcerated, it begins upon release, and if not, it begins upon the effective date of the suspension. Another change that's in the dash 3 is something that was brought up about those folks that were revoked under the old law for assault, and now we're making this difference of assault 2, 3, and 4 being a suspension. It's allowing the department to go back, and if someone had been revoked, this is starting on page 17, Mr. Chair, page 17, lines 29. It's allowing a person to be eligible for the new suspension treatment and hardship if they had been, prior to this act, revoked under the old law and not yet reinstated, or revoked under the old law and it's pending on the records. In other words, we give a 30-day notice. We tell people you're going to be revoked on X date. So anybody who has been totally taken care of and isn't, you know, currently revoked, we're not going to go back and change the revocation. It's been all cleared up to a suspension. That wouldn't make much sense. But if they're revoked under the old law for assault 2, 3, 4, they would be allowed to be treated as a suspension with those new length of suspension and a hardship permit. That's the substantive changes in the dash 3, Mr. Chair.
And I believe also under the hardship, we also allow for education for another reason going to work.
Going to work, looking for work. I honestly, Mr. Chair, cannot remember exactly all the different pieces, but it's the same law that we have today for hardship permits. Okay. They're treated exactly the same as anybody else.
Any questions on the dash 3s? Then the Chair would move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1207. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. The Chair would then remove Senate Bill 1207 to the floor with two pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. All carried. We will now open the work session on Senate Bill 854. We have the dash 5 amendments. This is a bill that comes to you from the attorney in the House and the Senate dealing with CLE credits. As attorneys, we're required to have what's called mandatory CLEs. It's a good policy. We have for credit dealing with for this and for serving the legislature, and I believe the dash 5, Mr. Taylor, are for one credit per month.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And if you look at what we do, it's a one-hour credit per month. So, in the Judiciary Committee, in a week, it is reasonable to do, and it does not remove our responsibility from getting our ethics credits, which we're also required to do. So the Chair would move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 854. Discussion? Objection? So the Chair then would move Senate Bill 854 to the floor with, as amended, with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I will carry. Next, we have, I'm going to skip 687 for a moment to cover the bills where we might have people here. I guess we're going
to.
Okay. Senate bill, then, let's go to Senate Bill 678A. Mr. Taylor. We're in the work session.
Chairman of the committee, isn't this the one that you still have at your sign-up sheet? I don't think it's
public hearing on it?
Public hearing on it.
All right. Well, then we're in public hearing. We're not in session. So we'll start with people that are in favor of the bill, and I would invite Jerry Purvis, Glenn Stonebrink, and Sharon Beck forward, please. And we appreciate your patience. I hope you found the day to be entertaining and interesting with the other topics we've dealt with today.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jerry Purvis, and I live on a small farm just out of Sheridan, Oregon. I've been contract logger for almost 50 years now, and I've logged as far down south as Yreka, California, and as far north as Tie Valley, Oregon. I've logged all through the Cascade Mountains and all over the northwest here. And I've had many bad incidences with vandalism and theft. I have supplied the senators with incident records from Anza County alone, and also the house site while I was at it, and they have been over 10,000 pages that was issued to you lawmakers. Just in Anza County alone, that wasn't all of it. There's been many incidences was not reported. And I think that this bill here would give us a good protection for logging and farming. I'd like to make a suggestion on line 18, where it describes fixtures. And I hope that means that the fixtures would be gates or fences or survey markers, because they destroy them. I give you a copy of...
You say on line 18, the word fixtures?
Fixtures on line 18.
Okay, I see.
For describes agricultural equipment, products. It means any real personal property or fixture used to produce in logging, horsing, management, mining, ranching, and farming, or any agricultural product, including trees. I have a document in here that shows. I want to give you two pages out of what I passed around a few weeks ago of mine that shows three violations in that report, and it lists the padlocks. You see pictures of the padlocks where they shoot the gates open to enter the tree farm to do the destruction. We keep the tree farms locked up at night, and they're open during the day. I also have the actual padlocks, if you'd like to look at them, to see what a bullet does to a padlock. I could pass it around, but well, my lumber wants them back. If you'd like, I could pass them.
That would be fine. Why don't you hand them to Senator Kathy, to Senator Nelson there? You don't need to take them out of the bag. Just go away and be fine.
I would like that to read on that line of fixtures. That would protect gates, which these locks are on, and fences and survey markers, which they destroy. Uh, The worst I've had in the 50 years was a $10,000 motor, which they, where I laid in the woods to catch some thieves, which I did do, and they paid a $100-some fine for trespass, and then because they couldn't prove that they were the thieves, the law couldn't, and so then they came back to get back with me. They doped up a motor, which I didn't have insured it. This wasn't on the insurance list. I don't know why, but it wasn't. And that was the most I ever lost. But there's people that lose a lot of money in downtime. But there's machines that cost $300,000, you see, and they've been set fire to.
But that's currently against the law to do that.
Oh, yeah, it's against the law.
And certainly you have a civil right of action against them.
No, it certainly isn't.
The problem is catching and proving them both from the criminal and the civil side.
Yes, but this isn't, when we mention in Section 1, a person commits the offense, it's not a person, it's groups of persons, organized people.
But that even that being the case, it's still currently against the law to do that. I guess my question is, if there are already laws in the book that say this is a violation of the law and you're not supposed to do this, and if you do, you will be jailed or pay fines or whatnot, how is this new bill going to help you? How is it different?
Mr. Chair, in respect, the laws aren't, they don't have no teeth. The fines isn't that great.
But if it's over $400, it's a felony now, I believe. Isn't that true?
Then why are we writing this bill?
Well, that's my question. Because
I think it's
under $400, it's a misdemeanor. But even if it's a misdemeanor, it can be up to 1 year in jail and a $1,000 fine. If it's a felony, that's true. And if it's a felony, a Class C felony, it's 5 years maximum and $10,000. I guess my question is, as I read this and read the other laws, I need to know how this is going to help you. Your problem might be that you don't have law enforcement or district attorneys or some law in the system where they're going ahead and prosecuting this.
Mr. Chair, I think this enters into what the bill's intent is interference. And they don't have to do anything. All they have to do is interfere, and I think that's fair.
So the interference part would be the new part of the law as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, the interference.
Okay.
And that's with agriculture too. I know that because I have a farm. These people, not just one person, it's always generally a group that want to have a good time on your expense.
But what my point is, that's already a trespass.
Cool trespass. I understand that.
And if they do any damage at all, they're responsible. And so you've already got a criminal prosecution right against them. Does the DA pursue them for trespass?
They will do that, but it's only a minor, just like I said, Mr. Chair, it's a minor thing. And they just pay that, and they come back, and they really do you some damage.
So, and I'm not trying to be obstinate. By making it a P felony, then, you're...
Criminal trespass is a felony, you say?
No, it depends on if they do damage. Simple criminal trespass normally isn't. It's a misdemeanor. It can be a Class A misdemeanor, which is a $1,000 fine and up to a year in jail. But your goal here is to create a crime that's a Class C felony, because then you think it will have more teeth and you'll get a better response from the DA and law enforcement.
All I know is that, Mr. Chair, that Senator, or Sheriff Hand is excited about the bill. And he's going to apply through Senator George's request for those records, and I picked up and submitted. And
well, right now, criminal mischief in the first degree is, in fact, a Class C felony.
Class C felony.
So the increasing the penalty, you've already got that if there's damage and the amount exceeds $500.
Am I wrong?
Yeah.
May I shed a little light on this?
Please, but do.
I'm Glenn Stonebrake with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and with me is our president, Sharon Beck. And this bill started out from the cattlemen in concerns with people that would not necessarily always injure. They may injure, but they like people who didn't like our way of life or agricultural operations would do things to annoy the animals and other things. And it kind of grew from that where it grew into the other operations that have similar concerns. And so you'll see throughout the bill, if I could just go through it quickly, on line 5, you'll see that it points out that these are persons who intentionally or knowingly, so it's not a hunter or somebody that's out on the land doing something else and accidentally spooks your cattle. So they intentionally or knowingly do these things. And it's on the property of another person. And the reason I want to point that out, because that's part of the amended portion from the original bill, and Senator Dukes had a concern, that what if your neighbor's cow gets into your garden? She said, I purposely want to annoy and harass that animal to get it out of my garden, and I might want to throw a rock at it or something. So we thought that was clear, but we did clear that up a little bit. And so you'll see as we go on down, then it talks about if they obstruct or impair or hinder or annoy or harass or disturb. And we're only talking about those people who purposely come onto someone else's property with the intention of deterring them from their legal agriculture or is expanded now to timber mining, with their legal operations of production. With that intent in mind, we believe that should be a Class C felony and not a slap on the wrist.
Okay, that's helpful. Yes, Senator Brown.
I have a question, and that is, I assume that this would apply, what you're looking at is getting at cases, wasn't it a ferret farm where somebody broke into the farm and let the ferrets out? Not ferrets, moose?
Senator Brown, if that, I believe, would fall under the ag operations, and it was an attempt to obstruct or impair or hinder that operation, then it would fall under this.
Okay, all right. Mr. Chair, that was probably not a good example to use because they're not considered a livestock animal, and I'm not sure they'd be covered under the definition of the bill. But I assume you're getting at folks who are doing, civil terrorism is probably a good way to put it.
Eco-terrorist.
I don't know that I would go that strong.
Oh.
Sure.
Yeah.
But
they're smart enough not to create a lot of damage so they don't fall into the current felony statute of $500 or more, because they don't damage something, but by chasing animals, releasing animals, cutting a fence, or doing something like that, they cause a problem. Is that the fair statement of what you're
saying? That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to say something?
Me?
Yes.
You know, I think it's neat the way the room's set up, Senator. I haven't seen you yet. You're just nothing but a silhouette there. Yes, I'm Sharon Beck, President of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I didn't come prepared to testify today, but since I have the opportunity, I'd like to do that. When I get home, my husband is going to ask me if I gave good testimony. And I'm going to say, yes, unfortunately, most of it was in the car on the way home. And the thing that we're getting at with this, that the cattle industry would get out with this, besides the confined animals that you were talking about, the mink and whatnot, we have people who, for instance, if you're close enough to town where people could come out, exercise their dogs in open range, and your livestock are out there, they think it's rather cute that their dog would chase cattle. We've cut cattle out of cattle guards, their legs trapped in the cattle guards after those kinds of incidents, or just people chasing them because they want to go ahead and get out of, they're on the road, and they want to get out of the mountains in a hurry, and so they'll chase the cows out in front of them. We have gates left open. We have fences cut. And as it is now, you know, anytime somebody chases and harasses those animals just for sport, when they're out four-wheeling or whatever, tearing up our meadows, those kinds of things, chase those animals, they're stealing from us because what we have to sell at the end of the day is weight. And if that weight is run off the livestock, we haven't got anything to sell. So,
but if that happened and your damages were $500 and tearing up your pasture is damages too, you'd already have the right to go after them on a Class C felony.
Yeah, it's a little hard to prove when somebody's chasing your livestock that they've lost weight.
But the tearing up, for instance,
pasture,
I mean, you can
tell. Oh, yes, and we do. Yeah,
I'm just saying. Have you had trouble with district attorneys?
We've prosecuted several cases, and they do. If the ranchers do take the case to them, but oftentimes you don't ever catch those people unless you find someone else who's been there, or if they get stuck. We've had instances where they get stuck in the mud, and they left their license plate in the mud, went right to them, and were able to prosecute. But it's the times that you can't, that you say they did it, they say they didn't, and there you are.
But aren't you going to have the same problem with this law because you still have to prove?
I think it would be a deterrent if it's more costly for incarceration or for costing them money. I think it's going to mean a whole lot more to them. They'll think before they do it, especially if we can get a few of them prosecuted initially.
Mr. Chairman, may I add to that? I can go back to the thing that I started with. This is for those who knowingly and willingly go about to do these things, which will be an impairment to the operation. So, you know, there's the casual thing. Did they knowingly and willingly set about to destroy your property? The burden of proof would be on us to do that. But the way it is right now, we may have a burden of proof that is so huge that it isn't worth it under the present law for what the type of penalty it would be for.
Let me describe a possible remedy for you, and you give me your reaction. We recently had a referee come to us and want enhanced criminal penalties because they're harassed and abused without physical injury in reffing games, either during the game or in the parking lot afterwards, usually by parents. So what we did was we made it clear under statute that this is a third-degree harassment, but we also gave them a civil remedy that you don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt and made it a liquidated damage and entitled to recover attorney's fees. So if that happens and there's no physical damage, you're entitled to recover a minimum of $1,000 in liquidated damages and recover any attorney fees, or you could take them to small claims court. Now, I think that will have more of a detrimental effect on those parents, and that's unfortunately who it usually is, than enhancing a criminal penalty. So in your situation, and again, it's the difference between criminal law and civil law, you don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, it's just by a preponderance of the evidence, that they, in fact, were on your property and doing these things, and that they automatically, you can sue for anything else you want to if the damages are greater, but they at a minimum owe you $1,000 plus your attorney fees. And that would apply to each one of them. If there were a group of them, if there were 10 of them, then you'd collect $1,000 from each. And the liquidated damages are such you don't have to argue about the damage. It's a minimum of $1,000.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, The difference in your analogy would be, and I've been a referee at times and had parents come up to me, so I know what you're talking about, they're doing that in the passion of the moment. The groups that we're talking about and that Mr. Purvis talked about set about in a scheming, devious manner to do away with our operations of our livelihood. You know, it isn't just a spur-of-the-moment passionate thing. It's something that they definitely do not like what we're doing and want to go about to cause as much harassment and destruction to our operation as they possibly can.
Right, and but that's a conspiracy to commit a crime, and if you can prove it, it's already against the law. Now, I'm not a criminal prosecutor, district attorney, or defense attorney, so I could be dead wrong, too, but those are the issues that fly through my mind as we talk. The other advantage on the civil point of it is if you're dealing with teenagers who are under 18, their parents are responsible up to $10,000. So it gives you that additional clout, too. If the kid doesn't listen to you, well, then the parent can pay the bill for you.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll get back to interference. I think this bill is for interference with agriculture, logging, mining. They tear up trees. I don't expect you to read all that stuff that I passed out to you weeks ago, but it's there for you to read if you want to. But in that report I just gave you there with the two pages, it shows where they just take a bulldozer and they tear up trees. That's interfering with agriculture or forestry. And they do the same thing with agriculture. I know what these people are talking about because I've got purebred cattle that I raise, just abandoned breeds. And I have that same trouble with them, but not as much as the logging. But I think that this bill would be a good bill. I think that it deserves a chance to. I think it's more than what we got, a lot more than what we've got right now.
Okay.
And I'd like to see this bill go through.
And I understand that. And I'm not.
There's one other thing here that I think where it says a person. Intentionally or knowingly. I think that intentionally isn't a good word in there. I think deliberately. I think we should say a person deliberately or knowingly. It's hard to prove intent. And I think that that's what they would use.
But on a criminal matter, you have to prove intent.
Yeah, I didn't intend to do that. I just went in there and tore up the cat. I didn't intend to do it, though.
But in a criminal matter, you have to prove what's called the mens rea, and that has to be the intent to do the act.
Right.
Sometimes the intent is presumed by the action.
Give us the law. We'll prove. But, you know, it's our job to prove it. We'll prove it.
Mr. Chairman, in that using her analogy with the mink farm, and we all know this is happening, it is terrorism, because they do that, they turn those mink loose specifically for a purpose. What is the recourse that those people, if they catch them, and they did, some of them, and they got no more than a slap on the wrist?
I think your problem there would be then with the prosecution and the judge, because clearly they're guilty of more than what would be a slap in the wrist. I mean, there's laws on the books where I think you could make that a felony if the DA chose to pursue one felony.
Yeah, I understand it. There wasn't.
Probably what we need is you to bring in the district attorney to tell us how this bill would help them. That's just one suggestion. Senator Brown.
I guess my question is, I'm not sure whether your goals here are to deter people from doing these things or to actually punish people.
To punish them? When you do catch them.
It would discourage them. This would discourage the whole mess. If they know they're going to have a Class C felony and these penalties. Now, that's just the top penalty. You know, if somebody that's... this makes one mistake or something, they're not going to penalize them all that much. $100,000 and 5 years in the pen. That is the maximum. And I'm sure you know that the judge wouldn't do that. But these three-time losers, they should have a penalty up there. I think that would discourage them. And I think this would discourage them from going in and growing their marijuana. That's why they shoot the locks off. They go into company land, and they spread their marijuana all out through the trees and grow their marijuana. And they want that gate. They don't want that gate there. They want so they can go in there and water it Most of these people are dangerous people, and they're groups. They're not just one person. They're groups.
If I may answer the question to Senator Brown as well, actually, that my answer would be both, because through our publications of the Oregon Cattlemen, if this bill were to pass, we would make it known, and I'm sure a number of our people would even post this to those people who might think about doing it. Then if someone does it, then the burden is on us to carry it out. To set an example, see, you didn't believe us, and the burden will be for us to push it through the courts as far as possible.
The reason I ask that question, if you're actually trying to punish people, you're better off using Senator Bryan's suggestion than you are passing this bill, you know, passing the language of this particular bill. Because his proposal makes it easier for you to punish people. But that's what you're trying to do.
And you want money in return for your damages. Well, let's hear from the other people that have signed up this afternoon or this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Larry Kleinman, Michael Dale, and Arthur Kunis.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Dale. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center. I'm here not in opposition to regulating the harassment of animals. I'm not concerned so much about animals here, but I am concerned about farm workers, and I'm concerned about farm workers and their constitutional rights. We believe that this bill is extremely broad and in its breadth sweeps into its coverage items that are protected under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. About 4 or 5 years ago, in a case called Pecun versus Goldschmidt, there was a statute which is actually still in our books in the law of Oregon, a statute which essentially would have permitted state circuit courts to enjoin certain kinds of picketing activity in connection with a farming operation. The federal district court in Portland, in that case, Judge Redden, declared that statute is unconstitutional. And yet this statute, under the Section 1, Subparagraph D, obstructs, impairs, or hinders, or attempts to obstruct, impair, or hinder an agricultural operation, that might well sweep into a criminal statute, that which the federal court has already found to be unconstitutional for the state to enjoin. Perhaps it would be curable by making it clear that the statute does not apply to a labor dispute, or to those kinds of activities. There might be another approach to it to get at the fundamental problem that the proponents are seeking, but there would be serious constitutional problems under the statute as adopted.
My name is Larry Kleinman. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of PECUN, the organization that Michael just referred to. That's Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United. We're Oregon's Farm Workers Union. We're based in Woodburn. The case Michael mentioned a minute ago actually only may seem like it was 4 or 5 years ago, but it was actually 8 years ago.
We must be having fun.
But I think this, first of all, the background for us in terms of what we bring to this issue, we share Michael's focus on what this may unintentionally do in terms of bringing in farm labor disputes. I don't think I need to tell the members of this committee, because there's been plenty of publicity about the kind of conditions that exist in farm labor. We contend that there is an uneven playing field in terms of the rights and options of farm workers, and as you all know, farm workers are not covered under collective bargaining laws. This clause, the Clause D that Michael referred to, would criminalize labor disputes. I'm not sure it's intended to do that, but that's what it would do. There's no way for us to know what behavior would be criminal and not criminal. There, it would also have a tremendously chilling effect on the exercise of constitutional rights. A chilling effect I would characterize as greater than the one that the court found, that Judge Redden found in the case Sekun versus Goldschmidt.
Let me alleviate your fears, and I do not think the proponents of the bill intend to include labor disputes. So if the bill moves forward, we'll specifically exempt that.
Very good. That, we would very much appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Arthur Kunis. I'm Research and Education Director for the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I strongly oppose this bill as it's written. in addition to the points that were just made, subsection 2 makes it a Class C felony to interfere with an agricultural operation. I can't believe how broad that is in language. That could, conceivably, you could be driving down a country road to, and stop to take pictures of the scenery, and if you block a combine from passing for a few minutes, you could be arrested for a felony. It's bad law for all the reasons stated, and the Oregon AFL-CIO opposes it.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd invite Jenny Berg, Rempel, and Andrea Meyer.
Yes.
Chair, she wasn't able to stay around to testify, but she asked if the committee is not going to move on this bill today.
We will not move on the bill today.
Then, if you keep the record open, she intends to submit written testimonies to a similar...
The record will remain open.
Thank you.
Andrea Meyer and Ingrid Clinton. And also Terry Lehman.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Meyer. I'm the Legislative Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And for the sake of the chair, Dave Sedanke is still the effective Executive Director of the ACOs.
I've seen in the hallway.
He is still in that position. The ACLU wants to echo the concerns first expressed by Michael Dale with our constitutional concerns. And not just labor disputes, but any protesting that exercises First Amendment or Oregon constitutional rights for free expression are clearly swept into, potentially swept into this bill. In addition, I want to point out what I think the chair has already touched on earlier, but I want to walk the chair and the members of the committee a bit briefly through, which is the significant disproportionality that this new law would give. As the chair recognized, there are other provisions in the criminal statutes that cover many of the crimes that have been discussed. Disorderly conduct, which is a Class B misdemeanor. Criminal trespass, which is a Class C misdemeanor. And criminal mischief, which is a Class C felony, and includes damage to property and livestock animals. The one thing that's different about all of these is that the standard is intentionally to commit those crimes. And swept into this provision is now the lesser standard of knowingly. So in this case, you are raising many criminal activities that could be brought under a lesser criminal misdemeanor charges, which in those situations require a higher standard than it would here. For that purpose, I mean, in this case, if there was businesses such as Nike and there were protests and other things to hinder, they would not be receiving the same protections. This is a very unique carving out, and we're very concerned that it both disproportionately does it and covers things that are really, as the chair has recognized, are already covered and criminalized.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. While we certainly sympathize with the proponents' losses, we also believe that current criminal law provides a remedy for most of the things that they've described. And sort of ironically, some of their language would actually add elements to those offenses so that in addition to the ones that you have to prove for criminal mischief, you would also have to prove in this case that it occurred on the property of the owner, and that's not required, of course, under current law. And criminal mischief, Class C criminal mischief occurs when the damage is over $500 or when it's a livestock animal. So livestock is already deemed to be a felony classification. The knowing mens rea piece, I think the only place where that would be a concern is in the area of annoying or harassing animals. For example, low-flying planes, a pilot would certainly have reason to know that flying at that level might disturb the animals, but that may be perfectly legitimate for that person to do. Some wine growers use these noise-making things to keep the birds off of the grapes, and if they have neighbors who have animals, presumably they would know that that would annoy the animals. So in that case, a knowing standard might not be appropriate. The theft laws also currently cover, for example, the release of mink, because in order to commit theft, you don't necessarily have to keep the goods. You can destroy them or put them out of the owner's control, and that would constitute theft, and if the value is over $500, that would also be a felony. I think the chair's suggestion is an excellent one to work with the district attorney from the affected counties and see if there remain loopholes that could be closed by legislation.
Afternoon. Good evening.
Yes. Good evening. Yes. My name is Terry Lammers. I'm with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We're a group of forest landowners. There's about 160,000 of us in the state. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this bill, I believe, is a result of a fair amount of frustration on the behalf of owners of property, animals, and machinery. And I do like your Mr. Chair, I do like your suggestion, kind of a different avenue or different direction for this bill. But I gave a talk in Tillamook recently, and one of the gentlemen present said that his uncle had a piece of machinery totally destroyed by vandals. And this is a fairly common occurrence. Frequently, these are not reported even to the sheriff in that county because nothing is done. We have property in Polk County. We've had vandalism occur, and frequently the district attorney will do nothing about it. There's, you know, the investigative resources are just not there to look into it. So nothing happens, and I think this is a result of the frustration that has occurred in many different areas of the state. So, thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Committee will do one additional bill tonight, and then we'll adjourn. I think it's one where there's agreement, and it'll move quickly. And for those bills we haven't gotten to, I apologize, but it's been 3 hours, and I told staff the committee we'd adjourn at 6. I'd like to open the public hearing then on 1210. Do we have agreement on that? We might do two, then 975 and 1210.
Sure, yes. No amendments. This is a bill which no one opposed.
I'm going to Senate Bill 1210 on the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 1210 on the floor to do pass. Discussion, objection, order. Carrier.
Hello. Go ahead.
Thank you. Then we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 975.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 975 is a related to dashboard amendment funding for the public body from disclosing information about undercover employees. And the dashboard amendments make exceptions to that. They allow the judge to allow disclosure.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, move dash one. Mr. Chair, move dash one amendments.
Thank you. Senator Tarnow moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 975. Discussion, objection, order.
Mr. Chair, move bill as amended as well.
Thank you. Senator Tarnow moves Senate Bill 975 as amended as floor due pass. Discussion, objection, order. And Senator Tarnow, Karen. Thank you. With that, the Senate judiciary will be adjourned. Thank you.
I have a question about the
What are you on for?
You haven't done it yet. Right.